I don't write for other people to learn. I write for myself to learn. But it's wonderful when it works for other people.
This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories and we talk about writing and life. I am your host, Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
Recently, on several consecutive mornings, I was sitting in my morning writing spot at the end of the red couch, and as I've reached for my coffee, I have noticed an ant. The tiniest ant you can imagine, crawling on the end table where I keep my books and pens and pencils and coffee. "Why are you there, ant?" I squish it, then apologize. In Still Life at 80, I loved how Abigail Thomas followed her observation of bugs, ants and wasps and flies. Because as someone with a lifelong bug phobia, I so loved hearing her contemplations about these little creatures. It showed me how to think about them differently. In Safekeeping, her very short scene sitting with her sister discussing how it might be confusing for a reader to hear about all these husbands. In a single page, she brings clarity to the three husbands she had, which children were with whom, and a general overview of the state of each marriage. This showed me how to write about something differently. The first book I read by Abigail Thomas, however, was What Comes Next and How to Like It. I was immediately smitten with the book. I could not put it down for the candor and non-linear storytelling of her best friend Chuck and her daughter Catherine. And if you haven't read it yet, I am not going to say any more. And if you have, I don't need to say any more. This book showed me how to structure a story differently. And in Three Dog Life, she so bravely strips bare the horror and sadness of the traumatic brain injury of her beloved third husband, Rich, and the mind-numbing shock that comes when your very worst life moments can somehow lead you to a new, unplanned, and enjoyable dimension of life. To me, this one was a lesson in how to live life differently. Writing and life are the two things, of course, that I love talking about on this podcast. When given the chance to talk with Abigail Thomas, thank you, Melanie Brooks, I gulped with excitement and anticipation and said, yes, please. When I invited Abigail Thomas to be on the podcast, I asked her if she might read from Still Life at 80. She agreed, but then asked if she might perhaps read from something new she's been working on. There was about a nanosecond before my answer, absolutely, I would love that. So today I am beyond excited to share with you my conversation with Abigail Thomas. I am so excited to talk with you today, and I'm really excited to have you on Daring to Tell.
I love being here. Thank you. I love being here.
I have to say, of course, I've loved your books, and there's so much that I think we could talk about. And often on this podcast, we talk a lot about writing and how we got into writing. And I'll say I feel like I know you because I feel like that's what happens when when we get to know people through their books. And so my question, maybe to start off for you, is that I know you began working in the publishing industry. And so I'm really curious to hear more about what that experience was like for you. First of all, just working in the publishing industry, but also in relation to how that set you into becoming a writer, being a writer, writing any of those things.
That's a good question. Well, I think I have to start by saying that I got kicked out of college, so I never went to college. I was pregnant, and in 1959, they asked you to leave, so I left, got married, had a baby. And then after 8 horrible years of that marriage, I moved back to the city, and I felt a little odd making because I felt so uneducated, but also very snobby. So I felt a little funny about applying for jobs at Viking, even though it was, as I did not yet know, the lowliest of jobs, but the most interesting.
Right.
So, and I think it was only because my father's books were published at Viking, because he wrote essays, Lives of a Cell, and I think that's why I got my interview. And I was 37, and everybody else there who was a slush reader or anybody who'd been a slush reader were probably 14, you know, very, very young.
Right.
I was older than everybody else. But I loved the job. It consisted of everything addressed to the editor-in-chief, anybody addressed to the president of the company. Anything that came in, what we called over the transom back then, without an agent.
Right.
Because editors didn't look at those things unless there was somebody in slush who found something that they thought was interesting, which right. I did. And I also, one of the things I realized, because I did work on a book with somebody that we bought, I realized that the part was so good was about this, you know, a paragraph that opened a book called French Dirt by Richard Goodman. It was a tiny little paragraph that explained what the book was going to be about. And it was really good. It was really a terrific little beginning. But the rest of the book was not so great. But by that time, I was an agent, and I was working with him on the book. And one of the things I realized is you can write badly, and then you can write really well if you go back with maybe a different sense of direction or just in a different mood, because the thing in the front was so good, I realized he was really a good writer, but he still had not written quite yet the good book. And that was very helpful to know, because I had written poems up until then, and they weren't very good, but they did get published. And I had a little book out from a little press called the Penumbra Press. But it was really interesting, because I had tried to write fiction or something else where the words went all the way across the page. And I would just look at it and think, who the fuck do you think you are? And throw it across the room. But as I was finding out how other writers began and realizing they did not begin perfectly, that was something I put in the back of my head and didn't lose. It was helpful when I finally did really start to try and write a story that somebody had told me, and I couldn't get it out of my head. I would write it badly and think, okay, I'm just going to sit in a different chair and start again. And so I would start again in a different chair.
I like that. What was the different chair? Like, it was a different way to think about it?
I guess it was both a different way to think about it, and it was sitting and thinking about it at a different angle. I really would sit differently in the chair, with a different angle on how I was going to tell this story. So it's literally true, and also,
yeah,
I got to try it from this angle. Then this isn't working. Right. I got to find the side door in. The front door didn't work.
Yeah,
but it was so. First of all, I think if I'd ever gone to college and finished, I would never have become a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think seeing bad writing become really very good writing was extremely helpful, because it meant that, well, first of all, nothing is wasted. You can write 500 terrible pages to get to the first sentence of what you're really going to write that you didn't know was what you were really going to write, because that's one of the nice surprises.
Yeah. You know? Well, and in a funny way, you also got through 8 years of something, of motherhood and a terrible marriage, as you say, in order to get to something that you felt like you were reading a slush pile. I mean, because I will say, when I was a little kid and I didn't really have any ideation of what I wanted to do, and I thought, what do I like? And I thought, I like reading. And I thought, you know, someone has got to decide which book, which, you know, how this gets to be a book. And maybe I could do that job, because all I would have to do is read all day. And so the idea of this, you know, and as you say, it's the lowliest job, but it's kind of the funnest. So I really was like, what was it like to be doing the slush pile? And before, you know, because that is some really great insight that you get after reading over and over and over and over.
Yeah. I also read for editors who had manuscripts that they needed somebody else to read before they did it. So that was fun too. I did that. I really loved reading and then just saying whatever I felt about whatever I had just read.
Yeah.
So that when I got promoted to edit whatever the next thing up was, that's when I left, because I didn't want a more important job. I just wanted to be able to do what I knew I was good at and liked doing, which was having an opinion about whatever it is I just enjoyed or loathed.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It was really fun. It really was fun.
Were you an agent next, or did you start working with writers, or what happened then?
Well, when I got promoted, I left because I really did not want to be an edit, whatever it was, assistant editor. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to have to write a report. I didn't want to care how many books it would sell. I just wanted to say.
I was going to say, it seems like it's about the selling part and that you weren't not interested.
No, I really just, I didn't want to be responsible for how many books it sold. I didn't want to be responsible for guessing how many. I mean, we bought, when I was working there for Cork Smith, a book came in called Stones for Ibarra by Harriet Dorr. And it was just a great book. And I don't think anybody thought it was going to sell, but we bought it because it was just too good not to buy. And I don't think people do that anymore. And then it won the National Book Award. Mm. These days, it feels as though an awful lot of publishing is about how much money they're going to make or who's doing the writing. So that's too bad.
Yeah.
So I left, and I had a tiny job at a private school for a while. And then a friend said that Liz Darrensoff, who was a very good agent, was looking for somebody to read. So I went to do that.
Right.
And that's when I started, not right away to be an agent, but to work with people. It's just being, you know, it's like a workshop.
Right.
Only there's only one of you there talking to the, and it's just, it's thrilling when you see how good it can be.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting, and it's such an intimate, trusting thing. You know, you have to trust each other and work hard. So that was fun. Then I had a very tiny vacation in New Hampshire out of nowhere, visiting a writer that I'd been working with. And there was a red pickup truck that said, "Too cute to stay home."
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be a very young carpenter. Most of my children were older than he was, but we didn't have that conversation. Anyway, he said, after we had a conversation with a huge snapping turtle in between us, I spent a week with him in his pickup truck and had a very good time. And then just before I went home, we were in the White Mountains and his head was in my lap. He was asleep. And I remember thinking, oh, this is how you do it. When you make your first pie crust, it won't be any good at all, but then you make another and another, and pretty soon you know how to make a pie. And I realized, well, that's what writing is. Your first sentence isn't going to be a good pie crust, but you just keep working at it. So when I got home, there was a sign that said, just get some writing done. And so I did that. I went and joined that writing workshop, and that was where I was able to write my first story.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually got published in the Columbia Journal of Poetry and Prose or something. And that was pretty great, you know, that it hadn't worked the first 10 times, but the 11th time it worked and kept going.
So, yeah, I like the hard work and lots of time and knowing, having that background behind you, that you know that you can keep going to come up with something more. And what about the writing process? Because on one hand, it is a lot of really hard work, yet it's also an exploration at the same time. So,
oh yeah.
Did you get hooked on that? Was that, yeah.
I got hooked on all of it. I mean, I wrote fiction before I wrote what I write now.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote two collections of stories and a little bitty novel, which was really fun. I loved doing it. And most of what I wrote was drawn from life, except for a couple of stories that I just made up, which was really fun. But when I started to write memoir, that was a whole new experience because you have to go places that it's very hard to go. You have to write about stuff that is painful to remember and does not cast you in a good light.
Yeah.
But it's the truth you're after.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clarity you're after, although you don't know that in the beginning. But clarity itself is comfort. You know, you can write about very difficult times and just everything that seems important. And you surprise yourself, which is one of the wonderful things about memoir.
Right.
And you wind up knowing more about yourself than you ever dreamed was there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Did you expect that off the bat? Or how, like, what was that discovery? Yeah.
No, I didn't even know what I was doing because I'd become very good friends with my second husband, from whom I was divorced. But we did become quite good friends, and he was sick, and I had remarried by then. Anyway, he died, and I just kept writing these little tiny pieces.
Okay.
A paragraph here, a sentence there, two pages here. And it was both things I remembered. It was where I was at the moment, and it was wondering what was going to happen next. So I used the first person, the second person, and the third person, and there was no narrative arc, and there was no... It was just really hard and interesting to write because I had to go back, or I didn't have to, but I did go back and remember things that I did as a parent that were lousy,
mm-hmm.
which was painful. But true. And I didn't know what I was doing. And all these little things I was writing just seemed like a bag of potato chips that had broken and fallen on the floor. It had no real reason for being, except that I couldn't stop writing.
Yeah.
At a certain point, I realized, oh God, maybe I'm writing something. So I didn't stop. I just kept going. And after a while, my best friend at that point had become my agent, and nobody wanted it.
Mm.
Everybody turned it down because it didn't do all those things you're supposed to do. Why was I writing in the first person and the third person and the second person? Anyway, Robin Dester at Knopf bought it.
Which one is that?
Safekeeping.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the next thing that happened was that my husband had a terrible accident and had a traumatic brain injury. So I mean, you don't turn that into fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And there kept being things that happened that were memoir sort of things. And
I was going to say, it's sometimes things are so painful that then writing is the way to, you know, I say process, but I appreciate what you're saying about how sometimes you just something grabs your attention, like the potato chip bag falling on the floor and you don't know why it's sticking in your head, but it does somehow matter.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to find out why this particular color blue keeps swimming into your view, and what is this odd feeling it's giving you? Or there's no more interesting, difficult, or there's no better high that you can get from anything other than writing hard stuff and figuring out who you are in this situation. And it's, you surprise yourself. If you end whatever it is you're writing where you thought you were going to end it, then you're probably doing something wrong, because somewhere along the way, there needs to be a surprise that changes everything.
And if you're not surprised,
nobody else is going to be surprised.
I love that so much. And I love, it's just, I mean, I feel like I'm the gratuitous oozing happy reader, because I go, I just love that that's how your books spin out, like how each tale is something unique to itself and all part of something. And it does go somewhere, but I know what you mean when you say there's not a narrative arc. And also about the high, about trying to put something down, I can relate very much to, I have surprised myself, or I didn't know that this is maybe what I was actually thinking. But then that doesn't happen again for a really long time, and I guess that's the hard work part. But with safekeeping, when did you, in my mind, there's some kind of transition point between writing all these scenes and knowing you had a book, or was a book in the back of your mind as you were writing them anyways?
The book wasn't in the back of my mind until I'd done an awful lot of writing. I guess I had maybe 100 pages when Chuck sent it out, and there was certainly more to write. And I was so lucky that Robin Desser bought it, because Robin asked, just every question she asked, I instantly knew the answer to. Mm-hmm. She was just brilliant. And it was just so much fun and so interesting and painful too. But she knew just what to ask, and I knew just what the answer was.
Yeah.
And it was usually something that I just simply had to put in. You know, instead of ending it here, I would write another 4 sentences. It didn't make the book much longer, because it wasn't ever going to be a very long book. I don't really know when I knew. I guess one of the things when you have, you know, 100 pages of various, that took place in various times and moods, and I thought, okay, I've written about the past, I've written about now, and I've written about after Quinn's death. And so it made a shape for the book. Mm-hmm. I could put things into 3 different sections, and they weren't necessarily obviously belonging anywhere in particular. But if you read them together, it made a kind of, not chronological, but emotional sense. Mm-hmm. Once I realized I could do that, I guess that's when we thought, let's see if anybody wants this little book. And the right person did.
It had to have been so exciting to meet someone who you feel like got it. I mean, that's what that was. It's like,
yeah,
I found the right person.
Yeah, I was really lucky. And it was a risk for her too, because it wasn't any of the things a memoir is supposed to be. So it was a risk for her. And it was wonderful. She was really just absolutely perfect. Kind of liked, unfortunately, become extremely proud that I did never go to college and wrote 8 books anyway. Sometimes I think there's such a thing as too much education or more education too soon. You know, you want to fail at something before, go out and fail at something and then come back in here. With a little, some kind of humility and reality attached to you than just, here I am.
Yeah. For college, I went to Northeastern University, which at that point had a I think they still have it, a co-op system. So you spent some time working and some time going in school. And I was just a liberal arts. I started off as an English major, actually, but then I switched to music.
Well, that's so interesting.
I wasn't sure what kind of... Thank you. Yeah, it was... They were both things I was interested in.
What kind of music?
And I thought it was basically classical music when I started there. I had always sung in choruses, and my high school chorus sang a bunch of pop stuff, like, you know, 70s Barry Manilow and other things like that. And then when I went to college and I thought, oh, I'll join the chorus, and they sang Mozart's Requiem. And I was like, oh, this is really something. Yeah. I have to find out more about this. So I became a music major because it was one of those things where I thought, I can't not do this. And then I had no idea what kind of co-op job I was going to get because I didn't know at all what I wanted. But there was a co-op job at the public radio station. And I thought, oh, radio, that's kind of interesting. I thought when starting at Northeastern, well, at least I'll find out a whole bunch of things. I can try a whole bunch of jobs and see what I don't like doing. Like, that was kind of my intention. But I ended up discovering something I really loved. So that sort of surprised me. Talking about surprise.
What kind of...
And I loved it.
What kind of writing did you do when you first started?
You know, I wrote in my little girl diary. Dear diary... I really like Ronaldo at school. You know, I had a bunch of little just like kind of confessional things. But, you know, I will say when I was about 12, I wrote a book. I wrote, I loved Judy Blume. And so she was very much sort of a template for me. And when I read it still, I think, oh, yeah, I was just kind of copying what I had read. But I wrote myself into a conundrum at the end, and I didn't know how it was going to end, and I gave up.
Oh.
Still, it sits.
It really does? It sits?
Yeah. Yeah. It's over there somewhere.
God. Do you reread it?
I have reread it. It's rather... amusing, embarrassing. It's... But, you know, I also go... Holy crap, I wrote a book. I mean, yeah. I'm trying to do that now, and I'm not sure I'm having quite as much success.
God, that's wonderful. What are you writing now? What do you write now?
I am trying to write memoir, and I'm trying to write about, oh gosh, I'm really scared to talk about what I want to write about. I am talking about growing up with a religion that didn't work for me, and how it impacted my health to the fact that I had gut surgery in 2015 and I lost half my rectum. And it wasn't until, this is kind of my premise, so who knows where it'll end up, but it wasn't until losing part of my gut that I started really feeling my feelings more. Like, it was really hard to grow up. I grew up without any medical care. So even though I had started going to the doctor in my 20s and sort of was like left that behind, what it does to your head is a little different. So I'm trying to go there. With that.
That is really interesting.
And I've been trying to go there with that.
It's so interesting.
Thank you.
What scares you about it?
That's a really good question. You know, I think that it's hard for me to admit that growing up that way hurt me, which is to say, my mom.
Yeah. You got to do it. It's not her fault.
Yeah. It's not her fault. You know what? That's... yeah. So...
So it's not a book about blame and revenge. It's just an exploration.
Right. It is an exploration.
So write it. You can do this.
Yeah. I'm working on it. And I know. Isn't that the greatest kick the can down the road?
It takes a while. It takes time. But yeah. Clarity is comfort. And that's what you get when you do this.
Yeah. How did you come to clarity?
I think the process of, it was different for each book. I'm not sure how I would say what I learned from safekeeping, except I no longer felt guilty for everything I had failed to do or done wrong. But the book I wrote about my husband's traumatic brain injury, I think when women are faced with a man they love whom they cannot take care of, they feel so guilty, A, that they cannot take care of him. And then after 2 years of trying to help Rich get himself back, and it was not going to happen, there was only one place that would take him without drugging him, and that was up here in Lake Katrine. And after a year or two of driving up to visit him once a week, I moved up here because it seemed silly to do this once a week, and he could be in good moods, and it was nice to see him. So I moved up here, and after a while, I had some workshops, and I made friends, and I bought a nice house and had my dogs able to be out in the yard. And I realized one day that I actually was enjoying this life. And then, here I am enjoying a life that was built on Rich's ghastly, tragic accident. And then, of course, you feel like you just don't deserve space on the earth. I didn't know how to free myself from that feeling of just terrible guilt. But what I do when I'm stuck with something, there's usually a word. The American Heritage Dictionary of Indo-European Roots is a book I always have handy. And when I was so upset about myself loving my life after Rich was hurt, I'd look up words in that book, because sometimes the original meaning of something will answer a question you didn't know to ask.
Yeah.
And I looked up guilt. It was just always guilt. And I looked up survivor, and it was always just survivor. And then I looked up acceptance, and acceptance comes from a word that used to mean a thread used in weaving. And that changed my life right then.
Wow.
You have to keep weaving. And I was weaving.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a moment of clarity that I really needed. I was really just living my life. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're supposed to keep weaving. Anyway, that was some clarity that I have been grateful for all these years since.
Well, if I can say, I listened to that book as an audiobook. In that moment when you came to that, especially hearing you read it, was so riveting for me. I was on a run and I stopped. I stopped and went back and listened again, because to hear when you had that moment of recognition of loving a life that was a result of a horrible, horrible thing and the guilt about that. That's not a moment that one comes to easily, or that one talks about easily. So I guess I wonder, in the writing part of it, aside from the clarity part, because one of the other things that's so prominent in your work is the curiosity and looking things up. And I looked up about these bugs and I looked up about these, and I heard you talk before, and I wanted to have next to me when I was talking with you today, my American Heritage Dictionary of Indo-European Roots. I Love it. Yeah.
Great.
It's great. I love it so much. And it's just how brilliant. Like, where did this word come from? What was the origin of this thing? And you can discover all these meanings that you didn't know.
Yeah.
So I guess where I'm going eventually, though, is, has there been any moment in all of your books that has come back to you from readers as, this moment was the most pivotal thing, or what I got most from your book, or what I loved most from your book? Or has that been something that's happened over time?
I remember getting a letter after Three Dog Life came out from someone who said, and I can't remember what her situation had been, but she said, I used to feel like the worst human woman on earth, and now I just feel human. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think a writer can have a better compliment than that.
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't hope for anything more wonderful than that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't write for other people to learn. I write for myself to learn. But it's wonderful when it works for other people.
Exactly. That's what I love, is somehow through the deepest exploration of ourselves in search for some kind of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
It can only be for ourselves, yet in doing that, somehow it becomes a broader connection. And that I find just absolutely magical.
Yeah, me too. It's just a wonderful feeling that what you're writing can be useful to other people, although that's not what I'm doing it for, but just wonderful. It's just a lovely feeling.
Well, I was going to have you do some reading if this feels like a moment. Do you want to do some reading?
Yeah, I'd love to read a couple of new things just to try them out.
Absolutely.
My friend, my dearest friend Chuck, died 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He was hired to be the slush reader when I was promoted, and I had to train him with some training. And I saw this extraordinarily good-looking young man who was very nervous, very nervous. And all I wanted to do was make him laugh. And I did. Anyway, the thing about slush is, I mean, it's mostly just terrible, but it's people desperate to tell their stories. And there's something poignant about that, even though it can be very funny. And so we would read things to each. Anyway, it's a good way to get to know somebody for the things that he found funny and the things that I found funny and still found funny 40 years later. So anyway, he died. We'd been friends for 40 years. And he died 2 years ago. And when I went to visit, my daughter and I went to visit him in his room, his hospice room in Brooklyn. And there was somebody had made a figure out of clay that was in the window.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at it and said, God, I think I'd like to make something like that someday. I said to Catherine, so she gave me a box of clay. That was before Chuck died. And then Chuck died. And I really didn't know what to do with myself because he'd been my best friend for so long.
Yeah.
So I opened up the clay
and
began to make things out of clay, faces and various things. And I think with grief, it's helpful if you can make something out of it using whatever is at hand. And it doesn't have to be good. It just has to be something that wouldn't exist if not for you and if not for your grief. And that's what all these little figures were, although they became a lot of other things. Anyway, so I've written about making them, but I've written about a bunch of other things too, because it's sort of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I'll read Deathbed Regrets. It isn't very long.
Okay.
When I heard about a magazine whose focus was to be deathbed regrets and how to avoid them, I pounced. There's no other word for it. I would write all day, wake up at 3 a.m, get out of bed and write until it got light. Then I made coffee and wrote some more. It was a little strange to be so rabidly and rapidly drawn in, although it was probably the word deathbed that grabbed me. I'm 82. That and regret. I have some experience with regret. Don't we all? At my age, there's not much future left, but I have an awful lot of past. I think of it as compost, layers and layers of compost, a metaphor I'm proud of because that's so exactly what it is. I began to list some of what simmers in my compost, scraps of pain, shrieks of laughter, moments of deep pleasure, terror, sorrow, grief, a lone feather that drifted past my window 3 years ago, rain, guilt, and oh God, words, so many words, spoken or whispered or shouted, written, read, memorized, everything bundled together willy-nilly with George Herbert's Love Bade Me Welcome, a poem I can't recite without bursting into tears. The trouble was that no matter what I included, it felt as if I was leaving everything out. So I decided to stick with the feather. I still prefer calling it compost because I've been plundering that fertile mess for years. But when I'm dead, it might as well have been just that one feather. So after the poorly improvised list of what my past consists of, I wrote, and a lot of regret. One lone feather and a lot of regret. What is regret? I think of regret as what guilt turns into when it grows up, or when we do. Guilt is useful when we're young. The discomfort of guilt illuminates how preferable it is to be kind and thoughtful rather than mean and careless. But guilt's often accompanied by shame, and that combination has a tendency to freeze me in its headlights, the kind of narcissistic paralysis where it's all about me. And I had no idea what to do to make anything or anyone better. A shotgun wedding at 18, 4 children, 2 divorces. I was guilty of something or everything all the time. Years passed, I began to grow up. The tiny perimeter in which I had tried to live my life had all but disappeared. And maybe forgiveness seeped under the door or grace through the open windows, I don't know. But gradually the guilt that had crippled me turned into regret. Regret does not cripple. It allows you, no, it urges you to engage and apologize if that's what's called for, or simply be of use to those who matter most, sometimes with words, sometimes with actions, often with laughter. I never want to outgrow regret. It's part of being human, and in a funny way, it rounds out a life. I've learned to live with it. Regret can hang around my deathbed anytime.
I love that.
I just love thinking of when guilt grows up and becomes regret.
That was perfect. You know? I really like that.
Yeah, it was really fun to write.
Can I also say one of the things I love about your writing is how you take some of these standard things that are supposed to be like deathbed regrets. Let's not have any. It's like, screw that. Let's have them. Like, if we have regret, we have regret. I find myself quite cantankerous a lot. One of the chapters in Still Life at 80 was gratitude. It's like, I mean,
oh God.
It's like, oh, enough with that. Bleeping gratitude.
No, God, I know that drives me crazy. There's something else that drives me crazy these days, but I can't think of which one it is precisely at the moment.
I know. There's plenty.
I know.
There's plenty.
I know.
Yeah. One of the things when you wrote back to me that I was excited to hear you were interested in talking about too is death, because I feel like I can't stop thinking about death either. And it's funny because your deathbed regrets, I feel a little consumed myself these days with. One of my obsessions is like, I have to do it right, whatever it is. Like, I've done this thing wrong and I've done that thing wrong and I want to do it right. And how can I make sure that I die right? So I like hearing you say, like, it is what it is. And when that's another kind of annoying saying, but to have a regret that is your grown-up guilt, if you will. It's something that's truly yours and that you've embraced and maybe come to. I don't know. Has how you've thought about death changed over time?
I can't remember how I used to think about it. I'm not sure I thought about death very much. But the way I think about it now is that the planet can't hold a species that doesn't die. There's just not enough to go around. Would there be just too crowded with everybody? We're supposed to die. I don't think you should worry about doing everything right. I think I think we're supposed to make mistakes. That's how we learn a little more. I mean, it's nice to get it right the first time, but then there's no echo. You know, there's no moment when you realize, oh, this is the way that makes me feel much better. If I do this way, or if I ask this kind of question, that seems right, instead of stumbling on it. I don't know. I just don't worry about doing things right.
Even if it's my own feelings.
Well, I don't think we have right feelings. I mean, we just have feelings. Yeah. The feelings are there, and they're not. We can't legislate whether they be the right feelings or not.
I know. I know.
No, of course, if you want to do things right because you've done things wrong, I understand that. But it's okay if you don't, because you learn so much more from mistakes than you do from doing things right from the beginning. It's more interesting.
It is more interesting. And I think this is a funny thing. I think part of my regret is trying to do it right is like doing things right, is not trying or not venturing or not making as many mistakes as I could have made. Not to say that I have never made mistakes. I certainly have. But I think here's another question, because here's my frame, which is fear. I am so afraid all the time. And I don't know how to somehow get out of it, to not care anymore, to just let go of the fear of saying what I think or feeling what I feel or living a life the way I want to live it. Not that I haven't, but there is a lot of fear in, if I say something wrong, I'm going to hurt people's feelings. And I know.
You're not doing it on purpose. The thing about memoir is that you realize that the things you don't want to write about and are afraid of, they have all their power because they're in the dark. They're all their power is in darkness. And once you bring them up and hold them up to the window, they may be awful, but they're finite. They have edges. And once you write them down, power's gone. Power's yours. All yours. Not the darkness anymore. But you know that already. So you just have to keep writing as if nobody's going to read it.
Yeah.
It's not going to hurt anybody's feelings. Just write the damn thing. It's going to be great.
Thank you. Do you have fear still with any of your writing?
No, not with any of my writing, except that it might suck. Yeah. You know. I don't want to write something that's just, I don't want to write shit. And
right.
I don't know that what I'm writing now is any point to anybody but me, but I'm writing it because I'm having fun writing.
Yeah. Well, I might not be, I don't think it would be shit, but maybe it would be compost.
Yes. Well, it is probably, it is certainly composed of a great deal of compost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little more about the other art that you do? I know the clay has been, I don't know if it's been recent. I know you have done a lot with clay recently. So I'm interested in hearing how that was. You saw that mask in Chuck's hospital room. And what is the clay like for you? Like, what do different art forms, do they do different things for you creatively?
Well, the two things I've done are I make things out of clay. And a long time ago, I made paintings out of glass, glass, on the other side of glass. And the one thing that both of those things I loved doing, is that they were both accidents. What I make out of clay is just very often an accident. I'll look at it, and I will very often see a mouth or eyes or a wing or something. And then you go and find the rest of that in your hand. So you look to see if there's something already there that needs to be found the rest of.
Yeah.
And it's an accident, and then you enhance the accident. And that was true with both painting and with clay. And it's really fun. The clay is very bossy, and if it doesn't want you to make a little boy today, it wants you to make a dog, you'll never get the little boy made.
It knows
what it wants. And if you pay attention and obey it when it wants to be obeyed, it'll let you have your own fun. But it really is... It is a very interesting medium because it does wield a lot of control over you. You can't.
I've tried, I did a little bit with the handbuilt, but I did a little bit with the wheel a few times. Mm-hmm. I like took a couple pottery classes, and it is really hard to move that stuff around. And you do have to spend a lot of time really like working it. And I watched like these little tiny people. One of the teachers was this little tiny woman. She like seemed like a wisp of a thing, and like she could really shape it.
That's great.
And I'm like, I can't push this damn thing. but yeah, I think it's a similar thing to writing about being surprised that the whatever it is that needs or wants to be created. It's best to try and pay attention to that.
Oh, yeah. You can't boss it around.
Yeah.
You can't boss your writing around. You can't boss the clay around. Because it's something else moving in you or through you that's really doing a lot of the work. And if you keep insisting on doing it this way when it wants to go over here, it's not really going to work. Because that's true of writing and it's true of the clay. It's much more interesting to let it be what it wants to be, but you have to look for it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the biggest surprises that came out of the clay for you that you weren't expecting?
Well, I wasn't expecting an angel with a broken wing that turned me into... Wait, I'll just read that. I have that here somewhere. It's just... Oh, sorry. Don't worry, this is only like a page because everything is only like a page.
Oh, that's fine.
Where is this? Making faces using the gray clay. Two little girls, both calm. One bird, another bird. And what now appears to be an angel with a broken wing. I'm suddenly deeply involved in his, her, its repair. But I don't believe flight is part of its future. The wing is too badly damaged. Is this how an otherwise sensible old woman discovers an alternate reality? To look down and find in her handful of clay an angel with a broken wing? No features on his poor face and no way to mend him? An angel who will have to make his way on this earth and learn to hide his wings? We're a dangerous species. Better warn him. The dogs are barking. Someone's at the door. I am making angels and birds and fish. An imaginary conversation ensues. Is that an angel? No, that's the sea turtle. Is that the bird? No, that's the angel. What's that one? That's the manta ray. Make another angel. It doesn't work that way. I show her the bird. It has to be an accident, I tell her, and then you enhance it. So I had this angel for, you know, a month or two that I was trying to heal. I still have it, but it really did feel like, so this is how it happens when you go completely out of your mind and enter an alternate reality and spend your life trying to fix an angel with a broken wing and no face. It was just very interesting. Oh God, there were other surprises, but that one I'll never forget. I kept trying to fix it. Anyway,
how about music? You live in a place where music is such a prominent.
Yeah, that's why I moved here instead of the other little towns for the band, Lee Von Helm. Yeah, but I just rock to it. I don't play it or.
You never played any instruments or anything?
Never played any instruments, but I do love rock and roll and the blues. But I was a very good dirty dancer, which was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago. It was really fun.
So you knew the band then?
I didn't know the band. I knew that it was my favorite band and their songs were my favorite songs. And
yeah.
Woodstock was right here, 20 minutes from where Rich was. So I got a house in Woodstock. It's too cool. It's too cool to be here.
It is.
I know a million things have gone wrong with it the way they've gone wrong with a lot of other places, but you know, people I really revere walked that street.
Exactly.
And it's just cool.
It is cool. I think it's cool that you live there, and it's fun to be in a lovely place, in an artistic place.
Yeah, because there's a lot of writing and a lot of paint. There's a lot of art here. It really is. I mean, I just sit in this chair most of the time and do nothing else except write or look around. So I'm not part of any of it, but I do love it. Restaurants are good. People are interesting.
Right. Well, I love reading about it. As I said, you know, reading your books feels like getting to know you. And one of the things about where you live and where I live now, I lived in Boston for most of my whole life. And I always thought of myself very much as a city person. And 4 years ago, my husband and I moved to Maine. So now we're in a very rural place. And I randomly picked a chapter to listen to from Three Dog Life this morning and got you telling me about the bed of nettles burying your peonies. And I feel like that is a definition of I've got bittersweet covering everything in our yard, and I am not a gardener, and I wish I was, and if I had time, I would be. That was another.
Nettles are really bad.
I bet. It sounds awful.
Yeah, they hurt and they get big, and you try to make tea out of them, but you just can't.
Right.
I don't know. It certainly could be worse. I got nothing to complain about. And I don't do any gardening because I just can't.
Yeah.
I just can't.
Well, it's one of a long list of things that I feel like I should do. And I just, but with all the other stuff, I don't get around to it. But
well, do you cook?
You know, my husband is the cook.
Yes.
I love audio. Here I am doing my love. I do my podcast. I try not to put writing at the bottom of the list, but I do. I, you know, when I wake up in the morning, that's my writing time, whether I'm writing in a journal, diary, sometimes working on something, revising what I've written for my memoir. What else do I do? I do a lot of editing. I've started working with writers to record their audiobooks. So that's been really fun. So I do spend a lot of time doing audio production work. And my husband's a musician, so I get to listen to what he does, which is also
wonderful. Oh, that's wonderful.
And I will put in, he loves the band too. We weren't at the studio when Lee Von was still around, but we've been to the studio to hear some of the.
Yeah, I think his daughter's taken over a lot of it.
And that was just.
It was
so
wonderful
when
he was here, though. It was just great. Great songs. Anyway.
This has been such a delight to talk with you. I have really enjoyed it. Is there anything else you'd like to say? I can't thank you enough for reading from some new things. If I can ask actually one more question about that, which is one of my questions about writing overall. At first you weren't sure when you had a book, but how now? How do you know when you do have a book? If you're working on something new.
I don't know if I have a book. I would, if Chuck were alive and he read it, I would know by the look on his face. And I'm not a good enough job. I mean, I know what interests me and what I'm curious about. And so that's what I write down. But I don't know if I've made it interesting for anybody else. I don't know. I'm having a good time writing, but that doesn't always translate into a book. Mm-hmm. That translates into you've had a good time writing.
Right. Well, it's translated into a very good book many times. So I think you've got a track record there.
Well, that's nice of you. Thank you. Thank you. This was lovely. Thank you very much.
After this conversation with Abigail Thomas, I wanted to look up the definition of the word accident in my American Heritage Dictionary of Indo-European Roots. And the derivation was the root cad, K-A-D, which means to fall or die. That struck me as I sat at my desk editing this episode, cleaning it up so as to have flow, clarity, but not so much as to erase the messiness. Abigail Thomas, you rock. Normally, I would be inclined to spell out all the lessons for you that I've felt after having this conversation, but maybe I will just end with this. Growing up as a Christian Scientist was very lonely. If I were to obtain the rights for a song, I think that I would play Stage Fright by the band at the end of this episode, but alas, I cannot, and so what I will do is put a link to it in the show notes. If you are just discovering this podcast, I hope you will click that little plus in your podcast app to follow it so that the monthly episode will automatically pop into your feed. I also have a newsletter where I send out monthly musings about these podcast conversations or other thoughts as they occur to me. It is called The Redo, and you can sign up for it at my freshly updated website, michellerado.com. Also, next month, I already know my guest will be artist and writer Blue Butterfield, whose absolutely gorgeous book features the art of her woodcuts. You won't be able to see the pictures, but she will read from her accompanying essays from her first book that has been number one on the main nonfiction bestseller list for many, many weeks. It is called Maine, A Love Story. And speaking of love, I will end this episode with the music from my love, Phil Rado, who writes and performs all the music on this podcast. And I, of course, thank you for making it all the way to the end of another episode, and of course, for daring to listen. I will catch you next month.
And nothing's gonna break my fall. There's nothing in the protocol. It's like swimming up waterfall or taking away the ground. Taking away the ground. It's like taking away the ground.